Hey, it's Boomer.
And Geo.
Boomer and Geo is both a radio show and a podcast. You can find us anytime on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods.
Catch the full episode, listen by individual hour, or jump straight to the highlights. Just open up your favorite podcast app, search Boomer and Geo, and hit the follow button to get every minute of the show your way and on your time.
Started the show talking about the Mets. Another day, another loss. The Giants win. It's now two games in the NL wild card race for that final spot, although the Mets do have the tiebreaker. Bottom line to me, and we've gone over this, BT, every which way you can, with Manaea and fighting with him, I disagree that it would be time to take him out of the rotation. It, to me, was the most encouraging start. While not good, encouraging. I know you want him out of the rotation, but I still feel like the Mets are going to be a playoff team, and I think that's where, you know, right now, a lot of fans are feeling the opposite, that the Mets are, in fact, going to be a playoff team.
They are, and they're reacting to the results, which I think is normal. If the Mets win tonight 7-2, guess what? You get a jolt of confidence, you get a little surge of energy and newfound bounce. Right now, when you're losing, and particularly in baseball, when you lose and you don't hit, you're right. The energy for both of us was more towards Manaea at the start of the show. If you guys missed it, Free Odyssey app, we got after it pretty good. I would not start him the rest of the way. 17 games to go. Give me the three kids. Give me Peterson and give me Clay Holmes and put Manaea in the bullpen. But the Mets optically feel flat right now because they're not hitting. And in baseball, when you don't hit, I know it's not a lack of effort or a lack of want, but it just seems stale when you go three up and three down as the Mets have the last couple of days. So Mets fans are nervous. It could change on a dime, but until it changes, right now the Mets are in a rut that they don't seem immediately ready to get out of,
Disappointing regular season. Division is now over, and you know they still, though, can go out there and make the postseason, and that should be the goal. Just get in, and then anything could happen, and then from there we evaluate. Now, if they didn't make the postseason, it would be a disaster of epic proportion. We discussed the Yankees a little bit. Ugly game last night, certainly an ugly inning. We didn't really get into the Volpe thing, but, I mean, it's the same old stuff. I'm tired of talking about Anthony Volpe. He should be down in the minors. He should have been weeks ago, months ago, when we discussed this. I don't know how you feel about that now, but
I think it's almost too late. I just bench him. It's gotten worse, though. Yeah. Like, when we did have the discussion, it was, I always said bench him. You said send him down. I said bench him. It's gotten worse. Like, now, you know, late breaks on balls over his head in the outfield and not getting bunts down. He's had a wretched season.
They've screwed up. And the manager said, on what planet would he be down in the minor leagues? Dude, this planet. It's, this planet right here. I mean,
from Boone, that's a weird comment.
The Yankees mishandled Anthony Volpe from day one. They don't want to admit it. They won't acknowledge it. We all saw what's gone on. It's gotten worse to your point. You can't play him, bottom line. Caballero is going to get the majority start. So, I mean, that's what's going to happen. That's my anticipations that he's going to be starting, especially in big games moving forward. The other thing we discussed, BT, the Jets making a decision to cut Xavier Gibson after the fumble. But it wasn't just that. Aaron Glenn spoke today. Do we have that cut there, Dove? So listen to Aaron Glenn now. I believe that this is within the last hour, whatever, whenever you addressed the media today, explaining his decision to move on from Gibson.
We released Xavier Gibson, and we will be bringing in some other guys. We already brought one guy in, like Isaiah Williams, who I know. He was with us in Detroit, I think 23 or 24. He was with us. And then we're going to look at some guys that's in-house. And I want to be known that decisions that's made are not rash decisions, and they're never based off of one incident. So, and I will keep it at that. Xavier is a really good player, and he's going to play in this league. But I felt it was time for us to move on in another direction. So I'll leave it at that.
I like it. You know, and that goes into one of the things you and I really like it. You know, I love it. You know, I said this on Monday that they should cut Gibson. I didn't know that they would. I love the swiftness and the decisiveness. But what you were saying was, well, it's a slippery slope. What happens? Breeze Hall puts one on the turf, or a star defensive player does something stupid. Is it the same penalty? And we all know there's a different code of rules for the stars, but what he told you right there reinforces what we said before. Hey, it's not the first time, and what you saw in practice, it's time.
I just wanted to dispel the narrative that everybody, because it is everybody, oh, the Jets making an example of Gibson and sending the message. That's not really what's happening here. He made a mistake. He's been prone to making those mistakes. He was fringed to be on the team to begin with. And they decided to move on now instead of having it come back to bite them again. So, yes, they held the player accountable, but it wasn't just for that one play. That's the big part here. It's not, you make a mistake, you're going to be out. There's that narrative around this decision, and Glenn just explained it's not just that.
Let's face it. This was a 2-foot putt. This was picking up.
Yeah, right.
It's a gimme.
Right.
Because he's had ball security issues. Glenn did not draft him. As a matter of fact, nobody drafted him. He was undrafted. He signed with the Jets as an undrafted player. And you got to respect that route, because just to even score a touchdown in the NFL after you don't get drafted, and he did house one to win it against the Bills the night that Rodgers got hurt. So we'll never forget him for that, and we wish him well. But this was an easy move. He's not very good at his job. You have no financial commitment. So let's do this. And now we can reestablish messaging and reinforce a few things. And you're not going to see this every week. I mean, you know, if Olu Fashanu has two false starts on Sunday, he might get reamed, but he's not getting benched because he's supposed to be a really good player. He's going to be. But I like it. It's a great start. And there's consequences, even if we can interpret those a little differently. And there's swiftness. And there's no sloppiness. And there's no acceptance of less than good stuff.
And also the way that he addresses it, head on, direct, no humming up, no getting caught up by some kind of question from the reporters, no on his back heels.
Yep.
He's addressing it. And just before we get going here, this is not based off of one decision. Here's the next one I want to play. I didn't hear this during the break, but I did read the quote, and I want to play this for everybody here, BT. It's Aaron Glenn when he was asked if watching film from week one made him more excited about the Jets' potential for the rest of the season.
You guys have the line of scrimmage at both sides of the
game. To be honest with you, after that Monday, like, I flushed that game. You know, so I'm excited about the things that we're continuing to build and how we're moving forward, to be honest with you. And I try my best not to look back and focus on, like, what just happened, if that makes sense. I really focus on what we're trying to do right now and continue to plan our brand of football, because I think that speaks louder than anything. So I'm excited about the players we have. I've always said that. I will always say that. Because I do think we have damn good players on this team. And with the coaching staff, man, we're going to do everything we can to coach these guys up to be a good opponent that's coming into our building.
Here's one thing I really hope for Aaron, and not even for me, as a Jet, like for him and what he's trying to do, because you're going to hear a lot about the future and excited about what we're building. I believe that, and I believe the building feels that. I know the fan base feels it. Eventually, early, you're going to need a win to support that, to make it even pop even more.
Right, because you can't go 0-5, 0-6. The results have to follow it, but come on, dude. That is music to my ears, hearing a head coach address things with honesty like that. You know what? To be honest with you, after Monday, we watched the film, I flush it.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there was a lot of good, he could have easily said, yeah, you know what? I'm encouraged the way that we played.
Yep.
It gives us hope. No, I flushed it. We're on to the next. We're building something here. Get the hell out of my way. Let me be. Like, that's basically what he's saying.
I
know
like
what
that.
I'm doing.
Yeah.
I love it from Aaron Glenn. But you're right. We talked about this earlier. The results have to follow, because if you start 0-2, 0-3, then it's going to be more difficult to keep that negative cloud, whether it's the questions, the fan base, the feel,
infiltrate
away.
The building.
He's
again.
He's going to need, again, I don't think they need 7 wins this year.
No.
You need some early wins just to let it know that it's working.
But I also think they could get 7 wins. Yeah. I mean, Miami's in trouble. The Patriots aren't going to score a ton of points, and obviously a few other teams that you could and or should beat. But listen, I don't want to get too wrapped up in like 0-5, 1-6, whatever. We'll just know.
Yep.
Like, all right, let's say that you never want to come out and nobody's going to get a thunderous applause for starting 0-2 at home. I don't care if it's Kotite coaching the team. You get 2 home games, you're generally supposed to get at least 1 to start the season. But, you know, it's 2 terrific teams, and now it's the Bills. But we'll know optically if the Jets lose 31-13 and Fields puts 2 on the turf and 1 in the hands of a corner for the Bills. Most of the steam, even though I'm saying that, of course, it could be regenerated, but at least temporarily, the steam is gone. If they lose 20-17 or 24-21 or 27-20 or 30-24, and it's competitive and tight, and the better team wins, that, oh yeah, by the way, is favored by basically a touchdown for a reason, well, we've got to maintain perspective. I don't want to say there's good losses, but there's losses that give me a little more reassurance that it's moving in the right direction. And I know it's early, but man, I've got complete faith in this guy. If Aaron Glenn fails me, I'm done. Then I don't know what to believe in anymore.
I know.
You know what I mean?
I do know exactly what you mean. When you're fighting off the SOJ It's a very difficult thing. It can't be erased in 1 week. This is a long process, but along the way, you're going to have some signs that you are heading in the right direction. I think success after week one, even with the result, eventually you're going to need the result. You also need to stream your local NFL game all season long, kicking off with the juicy week two matchup between the Buffalo Bills and the New York Jets, starting at just $30 for your first year. That's like $250 a month. Come on, it's nothing. Visit ParamountPlus.com/NFL to get things started today. BT and Sal on the Fan. We'll get back to your calls here.
By the way, real quick, did you see who's on the game for the Jets and the Bills coming up on Sunday? Did you see the broadcast
team? I did not.
Want to take a guess? CBS? How do you think that CBS views this game?
Profile-wise.
And it's not Ian. I'll give you that.
So then is it Nance?
It is. It's Nance and Romo.
You seem down on that.
Yeah, I don't like them.
Really?
No. Why would I? I don't think they're good at all.
They're the number one team. Would you rather have
what? They're
not
my number one team.
Tony Romo's been bad the last three years. They are CBS number two. If it were me, I'd want Ian on every game that I do or watch every week. But obviously, that's not the case. We just had Ian and Watt. They're going to be the number one team eventually.
Yeah, Watt's got real potential. I give it Kevin Burkhardt. I mean, I know he's Fox, obviously. But, I mean, I know that Nance is a Hall of Famer, and he was great. And sometimes it sounds big with Nance. I'll give you that.
Yeah, Nance and
no
Romo
doubt.
Can have a nice feel to it.
Romo's, I don't know, man. To me, Romo.
I'm into it. I like that.
He's been stealing money for years.
Yeah.
He came in. He has been. He came. What did they give him? $30 million? Tony Romo, whatever he's making a year, is a waste of money. Because we're going to watch the game anyway. And Tony Romo came in with an understanding of the league, which obviously he had because he was playing. And then that first year he was able, and you guys remember this, he was able to look at a formation, and I don't mean Dallas, and say, hey, Jim, look for this. And he was right almost all the time. But the first, and it was impressive. And everybody's like, wow, Tony Romo's amazing. He is the best we've ever seen. But more and more as the games get away in terms of him being retired, he knows less because he's in the building longer ago. So his guesses are less accurate, less frequent. And one thing that he does, and he's got to stop this. I know I'm getting on a little soapbox here, but this is 101. If you want to be a play-by-player or an analyst and you're a former player, the former player should never say, hey, Jim, what do you think you should do here, Jim? Which is what he does half the time. Like third and two, Jim, you think they got a runner or a pass? And then you put Jim Nance on his heels where he's like, oh, I don't know, Tony, here's the play. Like, that's not what Jim Nance is getting gazillion dollars to do. Give me the mechanics of the game, which Jim is still very good at. Tony Romo just is all over the map. And I like him as a person. I love Tony Romo.
I don't think
he's that good anymore. I'm sorry.
The good thing for you and other Jet fans, if you're not a fan of Romo, you probably don't have to worry about that anymore because I highly doubt CBS number one team is going to be doing many Jet games moving forward.
Hey, take it easy, buddy.
I mean, that's just this might be one and done. I was shocked Ian was doing it. The number two team. Ahead of a long.
Hey, it's Boomer
and Geo.
Boomer and Geo is both a radio show and a podcast. You can find us anytime on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods.
Catch the full episode, listen by individual hour, or jump straight to the highlights. Just open up your favorite podcast app, search Boomer and Geo, and hit the follow button to get every minute of the show your way and on your time.
Alumni weekend here, Alumni Day on Saturday. Obviously, the Mets also fighting for their playoff lives here down the stretch. Been struggling. Before we get back to the calls here, or Todd or Rods, whichever happens first, I wanted to bring up something I just saw on social media. Did not think we were going to be talking basketball today. But I just saw a rule change that I'd be curious to get your thoughts on.
Okay.
NBA rule change. I'm seeing this on Courtside Buzz on social media.
That's ironic because I just saw something about the NBA as well during this. And you and I were talking most of the break.
But not about the rule change?
No, about the Knicks. And nothing big. And I'm not trying to derail. I want to hear what you have to say for sure. But the Knicks brought in Coach Lang. He's been at St. Joe's college coach for about 7 years or so. I find that very interesting on the new staff. By the way, we both saw something about basketball during the break.
Yeah, weird how that staff has come together. But anyway, looking forward to the Knicks season, actually, when it does get underway here next month. It's going to be crazy next month, assuming that both teams make the playoffs. All right, so the NBA rule change. Unsuccessful end-of-period heaves will now be recorded as a missed field goal for the team, not the player, and players' percentages will not be impacted.
I like it. Honestly, I like it. I like it because I could already see you don't. I'll tell you why I like it. Common sense. There was a lot of times where you see guys, because it's always fun flinging that thing 70 feet in the air.
Right.
But it's not fun when you miss it, which you almost always will, and it goes against your three-point accuracy or your overall field goal percentage. So what you've seen, I'd say really it's become a bit of an epidemic the last 7 to 10 years. Guys will actually hold and wait till the red light goes on, and then they'll fire it. So it makes it look like, oh, I tried, but it's after the shot, doesn't count, doesn't go against my record. I actually like it. So you'll probably see a few more made because now everybody will shoot it. I got no problem with it.
See, Breen talks about this all the time, and I love it. He brings it up on the broadcast, acknowledging that guys are afraid to shoot. My issue is, who gives a, and I really want to curse, but I can't because this is radio, not a podcast. Who cares about the percentage? Like, what? How soft have we become that you're worried about a measly one miss from three-point range where we all watch? That's why it's not about the stats. It's not about the stats. It's about watching the game. If I see John Starks heave a full-court shot at the end of a half, I'm not going to say, whoa, he missed a three. I watched it. I saw what happened. Players are so soft and so worried about the stats, and everybody else is so worried about the analytics, that it's gotten to a point where they're going to change the rule and say, even though you shot that ball and it is technically a three-pointer, it's not going to be held against you, to encourage them to shoot because the players are worried about missing and having their percentage hurt. Holy crap. I couldn't give a crap less about their shooting percentages. I want to watch the games. Now we're making rules around this?
Well, that's an Adam Silver thing who has just played to these, you know, tries to placate players. He's not David Stern. Let me just leave it at that. I wish he was. But no, he's... I'm trying to separate the selfishness, which I clearly understand, and guys not wanting to impugn their own stats, if you will, versus what can I gain from
it? Like, it's good for the game that this is in place now.
Yeah, now you're going to see a half-court heave all the time. Now, what was it, within a second? What was the exact timing mechanism of it? Did they have it specific?
He said at the end.
At the end. I mean, that's pretty vague. I mean, is it inside of a second?
End of period heaves will now be recorded as missed field goal. Yeah, so...
But what does that mean? Is that beyond 50 feet, beyond 70, within 2 seconds, within 1 second? What does that actually mean?
Good luck deciphering where guys now pull up at midcourt with regularity trying to knock down a three.
Yeah, like, guys like Damian Lillard when he's healthy.
You know what it's going to be the heave as opposed to a
No, I know. I would definitely. But I mean, then why don't they... If they're going to change the rule, then just tell us... This is exactly what the rule change is. Beyond 70 feet or beyond 60 feet within 1 second, within 1.5.
Right, beyond midcourt.
Beyond mid. I guess it doesn't really matter. But again, big picture, we'll win because we'll see more more shots. And you have more shots, you have a couple of more circus makes.
Man, I just hate the idea of it. I mean, these players are getting soft nowadays. Not like they used to be back in the day where they were real men played the games. Like our next guest, Todd Zeal, who joins us in studio. Todd, how are you? Good to see you. Thanks for making the trek downtown here. We appreciate having you in studio.
Wow, walk in and jump right on, man. Yeah. Nice intro. Thank you. Good to see you guys.
Todd, how you doing? He's a veteran, Todd. This is a guy, you're right, when they used to be real ball players. Said he would be here at 12:30. It's 12:31. He's got the headsets on already.
One thing
love it.
Good.
You know, I was just going to say, you know, I have to flash the new ID downstairs and get in. Very high tech here. Got to... make my way up, but great to see you guys in person.
One thing I've learned about Todd, he doesn't waste any time. That's a well, Todd needs to be on set by 5:59. He'll be on set by 5:59.
Yeah, my nickname for about 20 years in professional baseball was Justin Time. That's what I used as my name on the road as well. So, I didn't waste any time, bantering about early in the clubhouse.
All right, so obviously Todd, currently SNY pre- and post-game, does a great job there, former Met. You do a lot of stuff for 9/11, which is tomorrow. You'll be doing that tomorrow as well. And we had you on, of course, ahead of the Alumni Day, which is Saturday. You playing in that game?
Oh, yeah, I'm playing in that game. It's going to be... look, I we talked about this. I turned 60 yesterday, and... when you look at the two rosters, you know, it's Shea versus Citi Field. There's a bit of an unfair advantage to the guys that are 15 years younger than us, and some of them just out of the game or still trying to play. So it should be an interesting one.
No, what about the guys who played at both?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of those guys that crossed over, like Reyes. Is on our side.
Oh, nice.
So they split them up so that we have a couple of the young bucks, but Reyes on our side.
Your roster's loaded, though.
Give me some names here.
Their roster's pretty loaded. You have the roster.
No, Robbie, can you pull it up?
I mean, unfortunately, the two key guys on the Citi Field side, David Wright and Daniel Murphy, both had previous engagements, weren't going to be able to be here. But I think the Dark Knight's going to take the mound. And I saw R.A. Dickey, which is just what I needed to see is some knuckleballs right now. Trying to stand in the box. And look, from our side, we've got Al Leiter and I think John Neese and Johnny Franco. But Johnny's got a bum shoulder, so I don't think he's going to be towing the rubber at all. And I'm hoping they let me catch just to get the gear on. And that's the safest place in the field with all that gear on behind the plate.
And any that's true. Any unless you run to back up the throw to first base, well, then you might do something.
Jog,
to kill these guys.
Jog, that, yeah.
any odds on FanDuel? No offense, I'm going with the other team.
Good question.
Mean, John Frank will get even throw. He might pitch. Give it the other team, dude.
It's a good question. I think. You know, we hope that kind of like when position players come into pitch and they throw at 58 miles an hour and guys pop it up. That's what we're hoping out of our starting crew. And Piazza's going to catch an inning. Paul Aduca is back in the house. And Edgardo Alfonso and Reyes. And Carlos Delgado is going to play first base for
you
our side,
got a
for our shade side. So
you look at the city field.
Okay.
I'm not going to disparage anybody. Look at the city field side compared to Shea side. I'll ride with Shea, even though. Like, you're 60. You don't even feel
he's 60 years old. Come on, he's 60.
Looks like he's 40.
He looks great, but he's still 60.
That'll all be exposed tomorrow. Or Saturday, I should say. Yeah.
Speaking about being exposed here, what do you believe about this Mets team? Everybody's in panic mode. I am not, for the record. I still believe they're going to be all right. What are you seeing with
this? We had
Mets
a conversation about this, you and I did in the studio. And look, I'm not in panic mode, but I do think sometimes teams like this, they got out to such a big early lead and played so well April, May, but it was an interesting type of well, right? It was great pitching, like, you know, best in all of baseball, starting and relieving, and not great offense, but still won a lot of games, built up a nice pad. And they've been, you know, the third or fourth, you know, worst team in baseball, you know, since June. So that's a tough thing to overcome, but they are a talented group. I think Carlos, you know, says the right things, and I think he's got to be a little frustrated, you know, day-to-day seeing the inconsistent play, but their backs are against the wall now. San Francisco's coming. San Francisco feels like they feel like they have a chance. I mean, the two games is really three because they have the season series against them, but I think this next couple of days is going to have a big impact because right now it was feeling like, oh, you know what, even though we're not going to win the division or we may not win the division, we're going to still make the playoffs. That's a given. Well, it's not a given anymore, and so I think the backs are against the wall.
I think this is a good read. It shifted, obviously. Not that it can't change with a nice win tonight or, you know, you get that fourth game against the Phillies. And I don't know if you have enough perspective from both sides, and you'll see what I mean in a minute, to give us a personal answer, but I'm curious where you go. Is the energy stronger within a team now, negative energy, that's fading, or with a team like the Giants that's surging? Which seems to have more push, either in the right or the wrong direction?
I mean, I would say that they are kind of a counterbalance. I think when the team's just floating, the energy and the sense of urgency is less. When a team's surging and driving up, then the energy's high. I would say San Francisco's got energy right now. They've got a lot of energy. They've got a lot of want. They've got a lot of belief, because they've been really hot for a long time, and they climbed from not being really in contention at all to now being the leading contender to jump to the Mets. And you saw it the first inning last night. Willie Adames hits a three-run homer, and it was like a playoff win, like a walk-off in the first inning. So you feel the energy from that Giants team right now. The Mets, I think, have been a little bit more steady, a little not complacent isn't the right word, but I don't think they've felt like their backs against the wall until now. I do feel like that energy may have to get galvanized for them to drive past this. And the thing that I keep saying, and I think one of the things that, you know, we both have talked about, Sal, is that they have their own destiny in front of them. They have, you know, they're still in the two-game lead. Their schedule is not overwhelming. They, you know, Giants play the Dodgers seven times, and the Mets have the season series record against the Giants. So it's in their own hands. It's up to them. They've got nobody else to look at. They've got no scoreboards to really watch. It's time for them to concentrate on what they do on the field, and they can control their own destiny.
One thing that is not up for debate, and we're in studio, Todd Zeal of SNY joining us in studio, of course, former Met and Yankee, but we'll gloss over that. One thing that's not up for debate, Todd, is that it has been a disappointing regular season. The division is now basically over, nine games back with 17 to go. And, you know, the win total is not going to be what it was a year ago, even with more talent, at least in my mind. You think this team is better than they were a year ago? And if not, then why the inconsistencies, why the disappointment from this team really all regular season long?
I wish I had the answer to that. I think if I did, I'd be, you know, applying for special assistant over there and try to figure out a way to get that translated. But it's been a weird trend in all of baseball this year. If you look around baseball, there's been so many ebbs and flows with really good teams and poor teams as well. But I've never seen so many like great streaks where they look like the best team in the world, and then poor streaks where they look like they can't beat the cellar dwellers. And, you know, so you start to wonder, where is the cream settling? You know, is everybody going to end up where they're supposed to be? Because whether it be Milwaukee or the Cubs or the Dodgers or the Mets or the Phillies, there's been 7-plus game win streaks and 6 or 7 game losing streaks and 13 out of 16 losses, things that I've never really seen in baseball before. So this inconsistency is something that's more prevalent this year, and I don't really know how exactly to explain it.
Is there something strategic that you think Mendoza can do differently, whether it's a lineup thing, whether it's, I don't know, being more aggressive, even though they do steal bases, just something to try to force the issue to get them out of this?
I think what is in his control and command right now is the pitching staff more so than anything else. I think he's pleased to have the three young kids up there. I think that brings some energy.
They saved the season, Todd.
They've all pitched well, even though they didn't get losses over this last weekend. They all have pitched well and shown that I think that they're real. This is not a fluke where you bring up a prospect from AAA and he has one good outing and you're not going to hear from him again. Yep. I don't think that's the case with any of these three. So I think that's a benefit. That gives him more weapons in the bullpen because the bullpen has been absolutely taxed. Helsley was a big piece that came over in the trade deadline and hasn't been able to be that eighth inning guy. He can never get to Edwin because they're giving it up in the middle innings. So I think his focus is there. The offense, as we've talked about, they were historically good in August, and the team went 11-17. I mean, they were the best they've ever been in that month, and the team was 6 games under .500. So that tells you that, you know, it's been an inconsistent run with the pitching not being able to get the job done when the offense has been, you know, firing.
We talked a lot about Manaea to start the show. What would you do here? For me, weeks ago, I would have moved him to the bullpen, have him be a weapon out of the pen because he showed dominance. I think you and I did talk about this in the newsroom as well. Last night, I was actually encouraged by it. Now, obviously, it wasn't a good start, but it was one of the best he's had, if not the best, and encouraging that he closed it out with 3 scoreless innings to finish 5. What would you do with Manaea?
I had the exact same take last night. I thought early on he looked a little dejected, and he looked like, you know, there's this this thing in sports where if you go out trying not to fail, you're going to fail. If you go out thinking, God, I don't want to let the team down, you're going to let the team down. And there is this moment where you're like, screw it, which is exactly what Manaea said. He said to himself after the conversation with Mendy underneath, after the bad second inning, it's kind of like, screw it, I'm just going to let it fly and let it happen and stop trying to do some things. And all of a sudden, you saw him free and easy. You saw some swings and misses. You saw him, you know, feel like he was more convicted with his choices. And he had 3 great innings to finish his day, which I was most encouraged by. So, look, I think if you thought, I think they did the right thing with Senga, as hard as that was to do. I thought that Sean was a guy that could be a bullpen piece because he is capable of being dominant for 3 innings at a time. And so he could piggyback on one of the other starters, like a Clay Holmes, who they've had to limit his pitches, and he's been having a hard time going past 5, but he's been good in those early innings. Those two guys combined, if they went with 5-plus kind of instead of a 6-man rotation, I could see him fitting into a role like that.
See, I wouldn't do that, though, and I hear you. I don't think the body of work has been good enough where I'm going to roll the dice with 17 games to go. Because if that tunnel conversation does not lead to what you guys and maybe some others think that it could, Well, then you could just flush another game away down the chute because he didn't give the Mets a chance to win early last night. He did stabilize. I'll give him credit there for sure. But if there weren't other options, there's nothing to discuss. The three kids look better. I think that Peterson has been shaky, but obviously he's been a rock and an all-star this year and before this year. And I think Holmes in totality has been better than Manaea. Zero is almost six. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm not moving mountains to do a six-man rotation or explain anything away. He is not, this is just my opinion, has not been good enough. I would not pitch him. I would go with five, and I will let Manaea come out of the pen.
Well, I mean, essentially, we're saying sort of a different version of the same thing. I'm saying if they decided to go to five and make Manaea a bullpen piece, I think that's an effective way to use him.
Okay.
If they are staying with six, then they're staying with six, and Manaea is that sixth guy, and you don't really have another choice in that matter.
But why would you stay with six if you're making room for somebody who hasn't been that good?
I think it's something that they're debating right now. I think they're making – and you heard Mendy last night, who has done a great job. He's very, very honest. That's one thing that I think is great about having him there, is he tells the truth. And last night when they said, is Manaea making his next start, he said – as of right now, yes. That doesn't mean absolutely yes, like he said about Sproat or he said about Jonah Tong, right? And so I think all of these options are on the table. They've got, you know, they've looking at what their off days look like, because you can give the guys that need the rest without having to have a full six man. So I do think that that's on the table. And I do think that Sean would be an effective guy if they decided to go five and have him be a bulk piece out of the bullpen.
How much of their struggles do you think just has to do with maybe a mentality? Like last year we saw the chemistry take them to another level. It's hard for me to watch this team, who's arguably one of the most talented Mets teams that I've ever seen. Arguably, I'm not saying they are. But you look at Lindor, Soto, Alonso, and so on. And even when they do hit, they don't win. When they do pitch, they can't hit. Like, what? There's got to be some kind of reason for the inconsistencies. I know we're all struggling for answers here, but you're a player. You've been in these clubhouses before. I'm sure you've been on teams that have had some sort of similar issues. Is there anything that you could chalk it up to?
No, and it's a great question because I think about it all the time. There was magic last year. There has not been magic in my mind this year. There's been some good stretches where they seem like they play as a team. Everybody's rooting for each other. It feels a little bit... I was going to say corporate, but it's not corporate. It seems a little bit more expected, I guess. And so last year was unexpected. So the magic was something that fans were able to gravitate to, and the team bought into, because, hey, there's something about being told that you can't do something, and then all of a sudden you're going to do it, and you're going to do it better than anybody else, and you're going to defy everybody. That's the way the team felt last year. This year, they were told that they better do it. They should do it. They've got the best team in the world. They spent the most money on the free agent market that has ever been seen before. So that expectation doesn't bring the same type of magic. I think they're going to have to find a way to rally for that a little bit right now, because I see some dejected faces when they're losing games that they feel like they should win.
Maybe they're just not having as much fun. Last year was kind of fun, and this year with the expectations, as you say, BT, with that crown, it's heavy, and it doesn't seem like they're having as much fun. We'll take a quick break. We're in studio with Todd Zeal of SNY, former Met, of course. Get into some of the stuff you'll be doing tomorrow with some Mets as well on the anniversary of 9/11. 888-8-
Hey, it's Boomer.
And Geo.
Boomer and Geo is both a radio show and a podcast. You can find us anytime on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods.
Catch the full episode, listen by individual hour, or jump straight to the highlights. Just open up your favorite podcast app, search Boomer and Geo, and hit the follow button to get every minute of the show your way and on your time.
1019 is the number to call, and I don't know why I gave that, because we have Todd Zeal in studio, so you could call us later on. You know, I gave it out of habit. We're joined by Todd Zeal in studio, and we have, you know, obviously of SNY, former Met, and tomorrow, Todd, I know you've done a lot of work with this over the years, the 9/11, the anniversary, of course, of 9/11. You're going to be at Firehouse Engine. This is what Jay Horowitz wrote.
I can tell you. I don't know. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to be at Ladder 12, Engine 3, which is in Chelsea on 19th and 7th. And,
nice.
This is something I've done year after year after year, and a guy that's become a really close friend of mine, who's Battalion Chief Tom McCarthy, retired last year after 43 years, but he was on duty during 9/11, lost five of his men. We always go and pay tribute to the guys falling, and I'm going to be joined tomorrow by Jay Horowitz and Al Leiter and Johnny Franco and Bobby Valentine coming. And, you know, as the Mets, Jay has done an amazing job of making sure that we always stay committed to this cause and never forget. And, you know, I think from that perspective as well, Jay was reminding me that, and I did some sit down for this as well. The Mets on their YouTube channel are premiering something called 11 Days in September. It's a documentary that really focuses more on the immediate aftermath of 9/11 and how the Mets and Shea Stadium played a big role in that relief effort. It became a makeshift morgue. It became a supply center, and all of our team became instant volunteers, not knowing what to do to help, but found some ways to be able to contribute. So they're premiering that this week, and I think as I had told you, I'm working on a documentary as well with the Major League Baseball Network for the 25th anniversary. So we're getting started on some of that tomorrow with this morning commemoration that we've done every year.
It's awesome. I've even heard, I remember Tiki telling me that the Giants were going to Shea Stadium's parking lot, yep, helping with food and whatever they could do. I mean, listen, it's a while ago now. The rawness begins to dissipate, but the other things don't. In the interactions you've had with victims' families, do they find any area or way to enjoy their lives? I know that's a strange question, but
yeah, and it is a strange question. And I think if I sort of rewind back to that moment, right? We come back from Pittsburgh on the night or early morning of September 12th by bus because obviously couldn't fly. And, you know, something I'll never forget is coming across the George Washington Bridge with a team full of guys trying to figure out what the world's going to be like. And we were getting escorted over the GW Bridge, and we could look down and see smoke in the air and lights streaming, and just realize in that moment the world has changed. You could hear nothing but a pin drop and guys crying on the bus ride. And so from that moment, we didn't know what to do. And fortunately, Bobby Valentine and Jay Horowitz and Sue Lucci from the Mets really kind of said, hey, we're going to be active and go down and start, you know, seeing what we can do to help. And I thought it was going to be invasive. And we went down there, right away, 4 or 5 days after the attacks, and met with firefighters. And we were walking into these guys in the most horrific moments of their life, you know, still digging for their brethren and thinking, why are we here? And then you could see them look up and see Mike Piazza's face or Johnny Franco or Bobby or me or Robin, the kind of the guys that were there, and just felt like they could remove themselves for just a minute and talk baseball and have something that felt common. That's how I traded a hat. That's how we got started wearing the hats in commemoration.
You were the first one that did that?
Yeah, I traded a hat for an NYPD hat, and then the other guys wanted to have that sort of solidarity from our team. We were told by the commissioner's office that we couldn't wear them because they were, they restricted the uniform violation. And there, all of this will be told at, in better detail with some other insight in the documentary that we do. But the reality is we realized at that time that even though we felt like we were invading into their personal space, they welcomed us in. And so we thought, okay, well, maybe sports has a way to help heal. And so I think that's what motivated us. And that's, to your point, that 9/21 game and the invited guests that we had, which were fallen families and children that had lost their parents. And, there's story after story about, families that didn't know how to react. Get a base hit. Was it going to be quiet? Are you allowed to celebrate? And the Piazza home run kind of lifted this this air and allowed people to say, let's go Mets, USA, and have a smile. And we've got some great testimonials that feel like baseball in some way and sports in a more holistic way helped them get through that time. And that's really what the story is about, how, baseball helped unite America, or at least New York City, at a time that you'd you didn't know what to do.
From a fan's perspective, I remember being excited that baseball was back, going to that game, and going into the same Shea Stadium parking lot where we used to park, and the field was totally different. And there were barriers everywhere and missing signs, and it was just, it gives me goosebumps thinking about it. But that's a fan's perspective as I'm going into it, like, holy crap, this is bizarre. And then kind of, you know, the anthem and all that stuff. From a fan's perspective, you had to play baseball in that game. What was that like going to the park and then showing up once you got there?
That's a great question. And it was an interesting one, too, because I would say maybe not 50-50, but I think the team was split as to whether or not we wanted to play or not. Okay, is it time? I was a proponent that, hey, Giuliani and Bush and the people that are trying to piece this city back together are like, hey, we're not going to let them keep us down. Time to show that this city is resilient and sports is the best way to do it. That's a great way to unite. So I was all for that. But some of the guys were still, you know, had a little trepidation about going into that. Was it safe? Was it going to, were five people going to show up or 5,000 or 50,000? We had no real barometer. So going in there that night, seeing the amount of security and, you know, the way that shaped up, 20 years later, I finally watched the game. I didn't, and I remember in my mind that what I remembered about that game was not the game itself. I had no idea if I got a hit. I had no idea if I made a good play. I knew Mike's home run, and I very, very little aside from that. But what I did remember was the national anthem, all the guys lined up on the field when the bagpipes came into the stadium, Liza Minnelli on the seventh inning stretch, singing New York, New York, and watching the whole place like erupt with emotion. Those are the things that I remembered, and I had to watch the game to kind of realize what happened to the game, to your point.
That's absolutely, I mean, it's, you almost feel, I almost don't want to transition, you know, because there's other things to talk about, but it's just, it's crazy. It's crazy to think where we were, where we are now. When you said not all the guys wanted to play, did you guys take a literal vote? Like, yeah, was it actually man for man meetings, and counted up?
We did have meetings about it. I don't know that if we'd have said, hey, we're not ready, if that would have been, I think it would have been weighted towards the overall decision, but I don't think we were necessarily the absolute decision makers. And I think there was enough, you know, sort of momentum around baseball and the commissioner's office and Giuliani, you know, say what you want about Rudy, but he was the leader in that moment of this city and kind of the heartbeat. And he was adamant that we've got to show that we can stand back on our feet and this is the best way to do it. So I believed in that. And I, you know, and by the way, the thing that's so bizarre about it, I think this goes to the point is like it's tough to transition. Well, the reason we still talk about it now is because, you know, a lot of the firefighters I go to visit, they were either 2 years old or not even born. And they want to know. And to them, a lot of what happened there and the way the city rallied around the first responders is maybe the reason they signed up to be firefighters in the first place.
No question.
Or they had, you know, a parent that went down in one of the towers and things like that. So it's the idea of never forgetting, which I think is what has really kind of kept this alive for us. And, you know, you look back on that moment now and, you know, World Series and, you know, great personal moments aside, there's nothing even close in my career that comes to the importance of playing in that game.
Tomorrow will be the 24th anniversary of 9/11. And then, as you mentioned, next year, the 25th anniversary, Mets will be playing the Yankees on that September 11th. Speaking of Mets playing the Yankees, they did so 25 years ago in the World Series. Do you still hate Timo Perez?
The hell was he doing?
I've had to forgive Timo. Your therapy, you know, says that you got to let that go. No, I mean, look, was I surprised at the time? Yes. Have I talked about it a lot since? Of course, because it was that pivotal moment in game one. And I know that was probably when you broke a speaker in your mom's basement.
I was living,
but
man.
Unless you were there. Look, I thought the ball was out off the bat as well. I think the reality is he just thought it was gone and figured he was going to be coasting around the bases, and it surprised everybody. And, you know, maybe instant replay shows that it snuck out over the top and came back in. But nevertheless, it just seemed to be one of those defining moments of that 2000 World Series and another thing to, you know, check on the belt of one Derek Jeter, because he makes the off-balance throw perfectly to Posada to get him at the plate. All those things had to align. And so, no, I don't hate Timo at all. And by the way, he was very good for us down the stretch and helped us get to that point. So all is forgiven, Timo. Come back and, come out to see.
Maybe he can pinch run tomorrow for you guys.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, all is forgiven from your perspective, not from mine. I still hate him. No.
I don't blame you. No, what's it like in the dugout after somebody makes a mistake of that magnitude on that stage? I mean, does Bobby light him up? Do you light him up? Somebody's got to light him up, no?
I think nobody lights him up. And it was one of those things like, it's a 0-0 tie in game one, right? In the sixth inning of game one of a World Series, of a Subway Series. It was a great game. It was, nobody had cracked through at that point. So it was a little bit stunned reaction, more so than an angered reaction. You know, it was stunned like, okay, well, let's get back out there because this game is still ours to win. And we took a lead and had that game still and lost it in the 11th.
Yeah.
And we had a lead in the 9th again. So, look, you can say that was a pivotal moment. I'm on second base. There's two outs. We've got Ventura coming up. There could have been other ways to crack through. But at the end of the day, we still had an opportunity to win it in 9 and wasn't able to close the door.
Real quick, Todd, there's been some shiftings. And by the way, Todd Zeal's with us in studio here, BT and Sal on the Fan. There's been some shiftings here where the Yankees have not won since 09. The Mets are spending money. Mets took Soto. Mets had a nice run last year. So it's changed a little bit. But when you're in the moment, and pro athletes aren't ever conditioned to think that they can't beat another pro, otherwise you wouldn't be a pro.
Right.
You'd be mentally weak and you wouldn't make it. But going into that, the Yankees were still at the apex of their powers, 96, 98, 99, obviously going into 2000. Did you think that you were going to beat them?
Yes, absolutely. I think I told Sal this at one time, and he's like, why? But we sat and as a team, we watched the final playoff game for the Yankees to determine who we were going to. We had already clinched, and we knew we were going to the World Series. And so I personally and a lot of our guys said, let it be the Yankees. We want the Yankees. We think, and we had, back and forth games during that season. The Roger and Mike thing happened, and the split doubleheader at two parks in the same day. I mean, it couldn't have been a more bizarre and interesting baseball year for New York City. So we thought, yeah, this is the way it's supposed to end. The Mets are going to unseat the mighty Yankees in a World Series. Bring them on.
But aside from the symbolism of that, did you actually think that they had weaknesses that you guys would exploit, making you better? What about that team did you think was weak?
I don't know that we thought that they had weaknesses.
Or vulnerable.
We just felt like we could beat them. We felt like, even in the games we lost to them during the regular season, we felt like we were in those games and should have won those games and could have won those games. And so I think, was it Seattle or whomever?
It was
sort of the unknown, and they were, we didn't really know them at all. We knew the Yankees, and we felt collectively like, hey, we can beat these guys. And we wanted it for the city as well. We thought it would be an electric, opportunity in New York City, and it was. It just didn't go our way.
It was a good try.
Get the hell out of here with that good try nonsense. BT and Sal, the fan with Todd Zeal in studio. A couple more for you. Todd, you were a good postseason player in your career. 29 playoff games, 292, 4 homers, 14 ribbies. Did it with the Orioles, Rangers, and the Mets. You think that postseason success is something that can, it's not the flip of the switch, but with this Mets team in particular, like, to me, I look at it saying they have some guys that can do damage there. Is there something to that upping their game? And do you believe that this team can do that if they do make it to October?
I've always thought and felt like when you get to those big moments, you want to see who's got that kind of inner, strength to perform in those moments, and not only to perform in those moments, but to want to be the guy in those moments. And I thought, anytime I had an opportunity to play in the playoffs, I'm like, hey, this is the stage that I want to be on. I want to be up with men on base. I want to be the guy up there. And I feel like my game got better. My focus got more keen. The bat felt fast. The pitching felt hittable. And so I loved anything to do with like big games, postseason play. And I think there are some guys on the Mets that feel like they like that stage as well and have shown that they can have success in that moment.
Todd, you came up in 89, and Sal and I were talking before he came, and we, obviously I'm a few years older, so I remember you, I don't know more than Sal, but I obviously remember your career very well. 89 to when you retired to now, all right? The game's changed a ton. Is the game better now in your eyes or when you first entered the game in 89?
You sound like an old guy if you say it was better in my era, but it was different. I think it was different. What I do like, I think the pendulum swung a long way towards analytics and three true outcomes and things that I didn't really buy into as much.
Yeah.
I thought there was certainly a world where analytics was going to help and play a part and give information that was interesting and maybe shape the game differently. I thought it went to such an extreme that I felt like the game became a game that was run by people that had never put on cleats and stepped on the field.
Geeks.
And that felt like, okay, you're eliminating some of the human element, which I think is the most fascinating thing about any sport, including baseball. So I think the pendulum started to come back. I do feel like some of the rule changes that they've made, that I'm a purist, I think have been good for the game. I think stolen bases being included back in the game is something that's good. I think the pitch clock has helped. And I usually get resistance on this, but one of the things that I think for regular season, having the runner on second in extra innings, I think has been a good thing. And why? Because I can remember during this time where I think the pendulum was swinging towards three true outcomes, I did games, and this is a personal event, but I did games where the Mets were on the West Coast. So the game starts at 10. You're in a 1-1 game after 3.5 hours and then go 17 innings of 1-1 with 30 strikeouts in the game. That's literal. I'm talking about 30 strikeouts on the two teams and a 1-1 game into the 16th and 17th inning because everybody walks up every at-bat either going to strike out or hit a home run.
Yeah.
And it became such a boring game to me that I'm like, something's got to change. And I feel like that was sort of the moment where the pendulum started to come back. And so I think the guys are better athletes now. I think the they're stronger. They're more committed year-round. They are faster and bigger and throw harder. And so I think the game is probably tougher today than it was in my era. But, you know, it's relative because these guys grew up with that same level of competition until they got to the big leagues.
For me, it was never about pace of play. It was always about quality of play. So in that game, 1-1 with 30 strikeouts, like, that's just bad baseball.
Agreed.
Not to mention that it takes forever. You think the Mets get in the playoffs or no?
I do. I do think they do. I think their back's against the wall. I think they feel like now, at least, I don't know. I'm speculating that, but if I were in that clubhouse, I feel like today is the day that, hey, back's against the wall now. We don't have any padding anymore. San Francisco believes they can overtake us. And, you know, and Cincinnati's not that far behind them. So, hey, it's in our own hands. Time for us to take care of our own business.
Would you change your feel if tomorrow you wake up, and obviously you'll be working tonight, but it's 9-3 Phillies. Like, are you placing that much emphasis tonight to kind of shift this
thing? I don't necessarily
think
it's a must-win. I don't believe necessarily in must-wins unless you're in game six of a series.
Yeah.
But I do believe it's an important game, and I do think that, you know, sometimes people will say, well, the most important games, you know, you never know which ones they're going to be over the course of the year. This is an important game.
One win can change the feel. They win tonight, all of a sudden it's, okay, deep breath. Even if the Giants win a game,
yeah,
just changes the feel.
There's no question. You know, how would you grade Lindor's season, like in totality? Because if we focus on Soto and the pitching and all the Mendoza's moves lately, we haven't talked about Lindor as much, and the Mets aren't hitting a ton. A to Z, Lindor's season 2025, what have you seen?
I feel like Lindor's season has been one that you're going to have to look back on and really analyze at some point, because it's felt like, oh, he's had a great season. He's an all-star for the first time as a Met, and he got off to a really good start, which is unusual for Lindor. And so you figured that lull would have to come. I think the lull took a long time for him to kind of figure out his way out of it, but he had built up such good numbers, it never really looked like his numbers sunk that badly. He's played lesser quality defense this year, and I think he would tell you the same thing than we've seen in the past. Even though he's been spectacular at times, he's missed some routine plays, and he's put a lot of blame on himself for costing some games with his defense. So I think overall he's had, I would say, a decent year, but not a great year for Lindor this year. And I think part of the reason that it's so important that he has a good year is it just seems like when he goes, this team goes. And
that's why I'm asking.
I mean, and you've got Juan Soto, and Pete Alonso's been spectacular with driving in runs. Brandon Nimmo's had his hot streaks. You've got the young guys that are swinging the bat well. But at the end of the day, when Lindor is hot, this team seems to follow. And that's a lot to put on one guy's shoulders because it's a team game. But when we've seen him warm up, this team seems to follow.
Last one from me. Would you go matchups based, or would you just say Beatty's our third baseman, or Vientos is our DH, or vice versa? Would you, McNeil in center, McNeil at second? How would you align those guys?
I may differ on opinion on this one, but I like the idea of Jeff McNeil in center, Brett Beatty at second base, Mauricio at third, and Vientos DHing. I've liked that for a while. It may be hard to plug that in because they put Mauricio on the cooler for the last couple of weeks, and he's on the milk carton, and we haven't seen him. But
keep running the bases the other night. You get to stay there.
I mean, I think that was something that was really starting to click at the trade deadline. You got quality play out of all three of those young guys, Beatty, Vientos, and Mauricio. Vientos was just starting to warm up at the trade deadline. They make the trade for Mullins. They've got to play Mullins. That puts Jeff back at second. That puts Beatty at third. That puts Vientos on the bench or at DH. And I thought you saw a lull because of that. Even though once Mark gets hot, this team has gotten hot. I've been a guy that I thought they had enough pieces at the deadline not to have to go get Mullins or anybody else in center field.
All right, go get those cuts in. We've taken up too much of your time today. You got to get ready for Saturday.
We can't say that in the air. What cuts are you talking about? I'm not doing any training for the game this weekend. I'm just going to go out there raw, Sal. No, I got to do something so I don't blow an Achilles like somebody on the other side of town.
Oh, we appreciate the time. Check it out. Todd's production company going to be working on a film for next year, as he talked about, the 25th anniversary of 9/11. You'll be tomorrow, Engine 3, Ladder 12, as well, with Leiter, Franco, and Bobby V. Thank you for your time, Todd.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Todd. Good stuff, man.
Yep, we'll see you later. Todd, of course, catch him out on the pre- and post-game show for SNY.
Hey, it's Boomer.
And Gio.
Boomer and Geo is both a radio show and a podcast. You can find us anytime on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods.
Catch the full episode, listen by individual hour, or jump straight to the highlights. Just open up your favorite podcast app, search Boomer and Geo, and hit the follow button to get every minute of the show your way and on your time.